KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, an energy company encouraging innovation right here in California. This is the power of human energy. Information available at chevroncalifornia.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, better late than never. After a marathon session, legislative leaders finally round up the votes to pass a budget.
It is often said that politics is the art of compromise. And let me tell you, this is exactly what this budget is. It's compromise.
Also, Meg Whitman's housekeeper problems scramble political calculations in the governor's race. We'll hear how she and Jerry Brown are now courting Latino voters. And the Arctic Circle is a world away, but we'll hear how climate changes there may soon be affecting us here.
The warming contributed by methane and CO2 from these tundra ecosystems will lead to warming in California, with hotter days in Los Angeles, and those of us who live in those areas know just what a really bad hot day means.
It's the California Report. Well, it took an all-night session and into early Friday morning, but the state legislature finally passed a new state budget 100 days into the fiscal year. Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers followed the marathon session at the state capitol, and he joins us now without any sleep, I might add. Hi, John.
Hi, Scott.
Well, this seemed like a done deal on Thursday. Why did it take so long to finally pass the budget?
Well, you know, these are tough policy choices, and really I think it's also tough political math. Not easy decisions. Things like deferrals of money for public schools, the delay of a tax break for small businesses, cuts to assistance programs for the disabled and child care. And, you know, that's a lot of tough stuff. And then you add on to it the tough politics here in California between Democrats and Republicans. And you had Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's an outgoing governor, who said the deal had to have a long-term public employee pension reform and state budget reform. That's a lot to bite off, especially in a state capital as polarized as this one. And I think those choices were reflected in the floor speech on Thursday made by the Speaker of the State Assembly, Democrat John Perez.
This is a solid but sober deal for California. But let's be clear, it's not a perfect budget. This is a budget that reflects the compromise necessary to find a two-thirds majority.
And John Myers, that two-thirds majority makes a lot of legislators feel like kingmakers because their votes are so important. What kind of horse trading went down? What kind of deals were there in order to finally get those last votes?
Well, big deals and small deals. Some of the big deals, as we've mentioned at the top, you know, this modification to the public employee pension system, that was a big one that Democrats had to do. They didn't really want to do. Republicans had to give up their idea that really this had to be solved mostly by cuts. That was another big one. But yeah, there were some real specific side deals that really are examples, I think, of horse trading, or as we say, the sausage making of budgets. One example was a budget-related bill that gives special treatment to two redevelopment agencies. Now, they're redevelopment agencies all across California, but these two are one in the Bay Area, one in San Diego, and it will allow them to raise more money from local property taxes over time. And the one in San Diego, we're told, could be eligible to put some of those taxpayer dollars into a downtown San Diego development for a future NFL stadium for the Chargers. That was pretty controversial when all that came to light on the floor of the Assembly, but it passed it. It passed the Senate, and it's in the budget deal.
John, the $19 billion budget gap is erased, at least on paper. How shaky is that fix?
You know, Scott, I think the fix is really all about the assumptions that are built into this budget. And really, the single biggest assumption is that California is going to get $5.3 billion from the federal government this year. Now, the documents that we saw in the legislature on Thursday night didn't have a whole lot of examples of exactly where that money is going to come from. And a lot of the legislators think it's the governor's job. And he has been working D.C., working the phones, trying to get the money. I asked the governor about it in a news conference just after the budget was sent to him.
I totally understand it when you put those numbers down that people are suspicious and they say, well, you will never get this money. But I think that we have a really good shot of getting that. Now, if we get it to the dollar, I cannot guarantee that, but this is an assumption that we can get it. And I think that I'm pretty positive that we can get that.
Although I imagine we've heard that kind of thing before. But, John, this is Arnold Schwarzenegger's final budget. He leaves office in January. Where does this deal, including the pension reform that he got, where does it leave him and his legacy?
Well, the pension reform, he says, is going to be big. I mean, he's talking $100 billion of pension savings over the future. We haven't seen the actuarial numbers yet, but that's the claim from the governor's office. As far as the actual budget year in, year out, we're still going to have a multi-billion dollar budget deficit next year. At least that's the projection. And the systemic budget problems in California have not been fixed. They were here when Arnold Schwarzenegger took office. They're here when he leaves office. And I do think that's part of the legacy.
All right. Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers. John, thanks so much. Get some sleep. Not that you need me to tell you that.
I'll do it. Thanks, Scott.
And you can follow all of John's coverage from Sacramento. Check out his blog, Capital Notes, or follow him on Twitter. Look for the link at our website, californiareport.org. Well, after years of being kind of a novelty item with techies and environmentalists, electric vehicles are about to make a big splash when they hit auto showrooms later this year. The Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Volt already have tens of thousands of pre-orders. In the first of a three-part series on electric cars, reporter Andrea Kissick tries to find out how feasible they are for everyday drivers.
I've never been into cars. I don't know an oil filter from an air filter. But my 15-year-old Honda is on its last legs, and I've been curious about alternative fuels. So, with electric cars around the corner, my dream of green motoring suddenly seems possible.
Okay, already it looks different.
All right. I spent some time behind the wheel of a shiny new powder blue all-electric Nissan Leaf, an aerodynamic four-door hatchback with a range of 100 miles. Paul Hassan from Nissan joined me for a test drive outside the Giants ballpark in San Francisco.
You're going to want to turn on the car by stepping on the brake.
It's roomy.
Oh, yeah.
I'm surprised because I'm like almost 5'10", and oftentimes in these small cars, I'm not comfortable.
You'll find that the rear seat is equally as roomy.
As Hassan launched into car salesman speak, I searched for the brake.
This is the brake, the big
yes,
one.
Yes, yes, yes.
And this is the gas pedal.
Yes.
Oh, wait, you don't call it the gas pedal. What would you call it? The power?
It'd be an accelerator pedal.
Accelerator. Okay.
The dashboard overwhelmed me with a confusing array of digital displays, including a satellite map of charging stations. Not many of them. And some kind of interactive bar graph that I think is supposed to tell me when I'm about to run out of juice. After several attempts to start the car...
Whoops, I hit it twice. That was too fast. Push it in, push my brake on.
You have to
press... I'm already can't even get this.
You have to depress the brake and then start
right.
I finally managed to start the car, and much like hybrids, I couldn't really hear anything. As we drove up over the Bay Bridge toward Berkeley, I was distracted by a blind spot because of the small back window. Otherwise, I found my excitement building as the car zoomed along.
So one of the things is this car goes fast. I mean, when you were talking, I noticed I was 72 miles an hour. I didn't even know it.
Yep.
I mean, wow.
Top speed is 90 miles per hour.
I could get a ticket in this car. It's a wild feeling, driving without a tailpipe. Instead of a gas tank, which might last for an average of 300 miles, a big lithium-ion battery sits under the car. One charge only lasts 100 miles. I needed to figure out, how would I get around with this kind of limited range? So I called on Carl Brower, an editor with Edmunds.com.
You have to probably have a secondary vehicle that you know is a backup that you can utilize. And what people need to do is get better about planning and not assuming that they can just go out and run four different errands coming back and forth each time.
I guess I'm going to have to become a better driver if I want to eke out every last electric mile. And the radio, heater, wipers, they can all run the battery down.
Two-tenths of a mile, right turn.
Nissan's Leaf may be the first real alternative to an internal combustion engine vehicle, but it has competition. The sleek, midsize Chevy Volt is a type of plug-in hybrid that goes 40 miles on battery power before its small gas engine kicks in. After that, the car can go another 300 miles on gas power. GM couldn't make a Volt available for me to test drive, but at a little more than $33,000 after federal tax credits, the car is probably just too expensive for me. I asked GM's Shad Balch, why the high price tag?
I don't believe the Volt is so expensive. It's an electric car that can be your only car. It really is the solution for somebody who doesn't want to have a pure battery electric car as their second car. You know, we did a full electric car back in the late 90s, the EV1. And there were three things that we learned from that product. One, it couldn't be a two-seater. Second, it needed to charge quickly and easily. And three, this range anxiety notion was real.
Still, the all-electric Leaf is just $20,000 after state and federal tax credits. That's more affordable. And it would get me one of California's coveted carpool stickers for low-emission vehicles. But one thing still haunts me. That fancy satellite map on the Nissan Leaf dashboard showing less than a handful of charging stations out there. I don't want to run out of juice and be stranded by the side of the road. Even driving solo in the Diamond Lane isn't worth that. For the California Report, I'm Andrea Kissick.
Next week, our electric car series continues as Andrea goes looking for a charge.
Our state is in a real mess.
Sacramento is out of control.
We've got to take the power from the state capitol and move it down to the local level, closer to the people, and no new taxes without voter approval.
For California to prosper again, we have to work on three things: creating jobs, cutting spending, and fixing education.
At this stage in my life, I'm prepared to do exactly that.
We can create a new California. What do you think?
Time again for Campaign Check, where we try to separate facts from fiction in the governor's race between Meg Whitman and Jerry Brown. This time around, the Latino vote and what those campaigns are doing to win it. Both sides are up with dueling ads in Spanish, including one about Whitman's housekeeper controversy. We'll hear more about those in a minute. But joining us now is Luis DeCipio. He's chair of the Chicano Latino Studies Department at UC Irvine. Professor DeCipio, good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Well, heading into the election, give us a sense of what were the biggest issues on Latino voters' minds, do you think?
You know, 2010 isn't that different necessarily than some of the previous years. Education tops the list. Economic concerns, particularly jobs, are very important. And immigration is important, as it has been for the last 20 years or so in California.
Well, as I alluded to a moment ago, the big story for the past week and a half has been that revelation that Whitman had an undocumented immigrant housekeeper for many years, she says without knowing it. And the SEIU, one of Brown's biggest union backers, unleashed this ad. Let's listen and then we'll come back.
Meg Whitman dice ser una republicana diferente, pero Pete Wilson está a cargo de su campaña. Whitman ataca a los trabajadores indocumentados para ganar votos, pero una mujer indocumentada trabajó en su hogar por 9 años. Dice que creará trabajos.
And the message in that ad, Meg Whitman says she's a different kind of Republican, but Pete Wilson is her campaign manager. Whitman attacks undocumented workers, the ad says, to get votes, but an undocumented woman worked in her home for 9 years. Luis DeCipio, that image of Pete Wilson, former governor, why is it that we're hearing his name in this ad, and what impact do you think it has on Latino voters?
A lot of today's Latino voters are citizens and are voting because of anger about Pete Wilson. The beginning of all of this was the campaign for Proposition 187 in 1994. That mobilized the Latino community as never before. So the sort of roots of today's Latino power in California are in part in the hands of Pete Wilson, who started that whole Proposition 187 effort.
In some ways, that's a very long time ago. We're talking 16 years. How effective do you think, is that still a real sore point in the Latino community, so much so that tying Meg Whitman to him will really move voters, do you think?
You know, it's a sore point for Latino leaders, certainly, the heads of organizations, you know, elected officials. At the mass level, no, Pete Wilson is not a as strong a message as Attorney General Brown could be sending. The dilemma is Attorney General Brown really hasn't found a message for Latino voters. He talks about his ties to Cesar Chavez, but for many of today's Latinos, Cesar Chavez is a historical memory. And Attorney General Brown really hasn't found a more contemporary message.
Meg Whitman has her own set of Spanish language ads and has for several months. Let's listen to one where she emphasizes her business background, and then we'll come back and talk.
Ella respeta a nuestra comunidad. Es la republicana que se opone a la ley de Arizona y se opuso a la Proposición 187. Meg significa un cambio real. Tiene un plan específico para una nueva California, con más trabajos, mejores escuelas y menos burocracia. Como líder de eBay.
Professor Scipio, in that ad, it says, she respects our community. She's a Republican who opposes the Arizona law and who opposed Prop 187. Goes on to say she has a specific plan for a better California with more jobs, better schools, and less bureaucracy. Setting aside the impact of the ad, does that seem accurate to you in terms of her position on the Arizona law that was mostly gutted by the federal courts, but one that targeted undocumented immigrants in that state?
She was very careful during the primaries and paid a price for it, I think, among some Republican voters to separate herself from the Arizona law. And I think she was very strategic in doing that, realizing that she'd need some Latino votes in the general election. She's undermined that message, I think, by her reaction to the whole Nikki Diaz affair, focusing very much on enforcement first and blaming others for her failure to understand Nikki Diaz's status.
And yet, in that same ad, she talks about jobs, education, more efficient government. And from what you said a moment ago, it sounds like maybe that is a message that would resonate to a certain extent with Latino voters as well.
I think the education piece would. She hasn't offered the specifics I think Latinos are looking for, specifically an expansion of education. You know, she's also spoken about making education more efficient, which is often a code for cutting jobs, whether administrative or teaching. Most of her advertising focused on Latinos has used that sort of message of business efficiency. And I'm not sure that that's one that resonates with Latinos. I think they'd like to hear tangible offers of expanding resources for the incorporation of Latinos and other immigrants in California.
A moment ago, you said that Jerry Brown hadn't really found a message that resonates with Latino voters. And yet the Nikki Diaz thing, I would think, certainly has gotten the attention of Latino voters in a negative way toward Whitman, perhaps. Is that enough for Jerry Brown, or does he really need to motivate Latino voters and not just have them say, well, he's not Meg Whitman?
What he needs is a ground campaign. The key issue for Latinos, particularly in off-year elections, is turnout. And there hasn't been much in this election so far that has mobilized sort of irregular Latino voters to vote. In 2008, a lot of them turned out for President Obama, and he won victories that he might not have otherwise won. My sort of gut instinct in 2010 is that the Brown campaign is just sort of assuming Latinos will turn out, and if they turn out, they'll turn out for him. That's often a faulty assumption. It got Gray Davis in trouble in 2002, and it got Cruz Bustamante in trouble in 2003.
All right. That's Luis DeCipio, chair of the Chicano Latino Studies Department at UC Irvine. Professor DeCipio, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
And now from the heat of politics to global warming, measuring the extent of Arctic sea ice at the end of the summer is one of the ways scientists analyze the impacts of climate change. Preliminary measurements are just out for 2010, and it looks like this year sea ice hit its third lowest level in more than 30 years. Together, 2007 through 2010 are the four lowest sea ice years on record. Now, while the far north may seem like a world away from California, scientists say changes there could very likely be affecting us here in the not-too-distant future. Climate Watch producer Gretchen Weber went to the Arctic Circle to investigate.
That's the helicopter flying away, leaving me in the middle of the wide-open tundra on the north slope of Alaska's Brooks Range, about 140 miles south of the Arctic Ocean. I've been invited here as bear protection for Andrew Balser, a researcher at the University of Fairbanks. Grizzly bears seem like a distant threat compared with these swarming hordes of mosquitoes, but Balser seems impervious to them. He's dressed in canvas overalls that don't look like they've ever seen a washing machine, and it turns out that's part of his strategy.
For some reason, it always seems like the person who is the most bathed and well scrubbed is the one that gets it. I'm not sure why. So, yeah, it pays to be a grubby field worker. out here.
Balser is here studying thermokarsts, big gullies that sometimes form in the Arctic when the layer of underground frozen soil, called permafrost, thaws, and the ground above it either caves in or slides down a hillside. Thermokarsts scar the land, and they dump sediment into nearby streams, sometimes dramatically altering habitats for fish and other aquatic organisms. And they've even been known to swallow the occasional house. But thermokarsts are part of a much larger issue, too, one with global consequences. They're showing up more often in parts of Alaska, and scientists say this is no coincidence.
Thermokarsts are very small, and so it's easier to see, yeah, who cares about thermokarst?
Josh Schimmel is a soil ecologist at UC Santa Barbara.
The Arctic is the air conditioner for the entire planet, and the air conditioner is breaking.
Scientists say that if you add up all the carbon that's circulating in the atmosphere right now in the form of CO2, methane, and other greenhouse gases, there's at least that much more locked up in permafrost. The Arctic is heating up twice as fast as the rest of the planet, and that permafrost is thawing, which means that organic matter that's been frozen for thousands of years in some cases is decomposing and releasing that carbon. Much of it is greenhouse gases. More carbon in the atmosphere means more warming, which means more thawing permafrost. It's a vicious cycle known as a positive feedback, and it has potential consequences for the entire global climate system, including right here in California.
The warming contributed by methane and CO2 from these tundra ecosystems will lead to warming in California, with hotter days in Los Angeles, and those of us who live in those areas know just what a really bad hot day means. It will contribute to the loss of the snowpack in the Sierra and contribute to water problems.
On Alaska's North Slope, in a region unofficially dubbed the Valley of the Thermokarsts, Balser is looking at just one piece of this thawing permafrost puzzle. He's trying to figure out why thermokarsts form where they do. We mucked our way across a stream and then hiked several hundred meters up from the valley floor, across the uneven tussock, to the top of a good-sized thermokarst, a jagged depression extending down the hillside, about 5 feet deep and wider than a tennis court. Balser picks a spot near the top, unpacks a thin shovel, and starts digging into the side wall of the thermokarst.
Oh, wait, there it is. It is permafrost. So check it out. If you take the shovel and hit rock, you get kind of that ring in the shovel. If you hit permafrost, it's kind of like a dull thud.
Balser keeps digging, and soon we can see layers of silt and gravel, unfrozen ones on top, permafrost below.
Yeah, this is sweet. This is really good, actually. It takes a real geek to get excited about this.
Balser spent the summer digging into as many thermokarsts as he could. He'll use his data to construct a map that will help predict where in Alaska they're likely to show up as temperatures warm.
In environmental sciences, it's often difficult to say where a tipping point is. You know, we hem and haw about where it's going to be.
Breck Bowden of the University of Vermont heads up a large thermokarst research project in Alaska. And he says there's no debate about the melting point of ice.
This one, there's no arguing. 0 degrees centigrade is a tipping point, you know? You go beyond that, and it tips, okay? And the trajectory is clear.
Bowden says that in the next 50 years, we could lose half of the permafrost in the Arctic, which could set into motion some irreversible changes. A sudden release of even a portion of the carbon that's stored in the frozen soils of the Arctic could push the region and the globe past a tipping point.
Why should somebody who's living in Alabama or in Nigeria or in the Philippines worry about what's going on in the Arctic? Well, you should worry a lot, because what happens here is going to affect everything in the globe.
And scientists here in the Arctic warn that once some of those effects get underway, they may be beyond our control. For the California Report, I'm Gretchen Weber in the Arctic Circle.
And to see for yourself what a thermokarst looks like, head on over to our website, californiareport.org/climatewatch. And finally today, Los Angeles is often a backdrop in the fiction of crime writer James Ellroy. Best known for novels such as L.A. Confidential and The Black Dahlia, Ellroy is back living in his native Los Angeles after a decade away, and he has a new memoir. Book critic Oscar Villalón has this review.
In 1992, James Ellroy capped his uber-dark, four-book noir masterpiece, The L.A. Quartet, with his novel White Jazz. Unlike the other books before it in the series, The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere, and L.A. Confidential, this final novel about corruption and depravity in mid-century Los Angeles popped with a unique prose style. It was a punchy, rat-a-tat shorthand, one laden with slang and wordplay. Given the hyped-up violence and rampant treachery in white jazz, the style worked. You felt you were maneuvering in a malevolent world where you only had time to think in split seconds. The style, though, stuck. It worked in later books, such as his first memoir, My Dark Places, about the unsolved 50s murder of his mother, Jean Hilliker, and American Tabloid, his fictional retelling of the JFK assassination. And then it didn't. His 2001 novel, The Cold 6000, and last year's Blood's a Rover are exhausting. Elroy's prose became even more compressed, more telegraphic, mutating into a collection of sentence fragments and word blips. It turns out there's a probable explanation for his collapsing prose. Around the time he wrote both books, he pretty much had lost his mind, recovered his bearings, and then was trying to stay sane. The cause of his hell? An unhealthy fixation, to put it mildly, on women, a curse born from his troubled relationship with his late mother. Which brings us to Elroy's new book and second memoir, The Hilliker Curse, My Pursuit of Women. Elroy has wisely loosened the reins on his prose. He has adopted the advice of his second ex-wife, author Helen Knode, who, Elroy writes, told him to create a less rigorous style and shape it with greater emotion. The problem is that greater emotion here means a cringe-inducing baring of his soul, a disturbing recounting of the mental pathology that led to the end of his second marriage and spurred him into doomed relationships in the wake of its breakup. For Elroy's legions of fans, there are some interesting things here. We learn more about his early and present career, about his politics and his faith, and his taste in culture. We can see how he uses his writing to both discover and fool himself about who he is. And you appreciate the pivotal role Helen Knode plays in his life. Unfortunately, The Hilliker Curse proves both creepy and tedious. Brooding in dark rooms, imprisoned in overheated affairs, worshipping Anne Sexton and Anne Sophie von Otter are the least of it. Elroy knows no bounds when pursuing women. His wretched anxieties run rampant. Elroy, now 62, has cast himself as one of the damaged, self-destructive leads from the L.A. Quartet. He's willing to risk it all for the promise of a soulmate. And in the end, while at the Los Angeles Times Book Festival, he finally finds her. I am predisposed to rash and thoughtless acts in love's name. This memoir will help me interdict this practice, Elroy writes. It's as if by pouring all his torment into this book, and by copping to all his flaws, he believes he can now move on with his new love. But nothing has been convincingly processed here, only nakedly related. Elroy claims he's better. Let's hope he's right.
Oscar Villalón reviews books for NPR.org and others. He reviewed The Hilliker Curse, My Pursuit of Women, by James Elroy. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering by Howard Gelman. Victoria Malione is our producer. Our senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen with help from David Marks. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities across California. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The SunPower Corporation, online at sunpowersolar.com.